BBC Five Live.
It's all about gadgets and technology on our phone in tonight. If you're having any problems or you need something explaining, you can talk to our expert, Fevzi Turkapp. You can call 08 085 909 693. You can text us on 85058. You can email us as well, upallnight@bbc.co.uk, or you can get in touch with us on social media using @BBC Five Live. Now, basically, that's taken us all the way through the whole programme. Just getting through that far, that part of it there is pretty much half our programme. Fevzi, a very good morning to you. How are you?
Morning. I'm well, thank you.
It's very good to be talking to you. I was looking at some of the things that you've got to talk about tonight. There's quite a lot of hardware in there, isn't there? There's like, and not the sort of like the interesting things like new phones being released or new huge bits of technology. It's a lot about the things that are inside.
Yeah. So, for example, we heard about the fact that processors that are in almost every computer that we use, be it desktop, laptop, tablet, or smartphone, are potentially affected by two security flaws in the actual chips. One is called Spectre and the other one is called Meltdown. And Intel particularly badly hit in that Intel processors are victims of both of those. AMD and ARM and some of the other processor manufacturers slightly less so. It's still an evolving picture. But it is interesting because what they've found out is a technique that has been used in making processors faster for the last 20 years has got a serious security flaw. And it is possible to write software that takes advantage of that. I guess one would call it a design flaw. It's not a bug in the traditional sense of being in software. It's possible to get malware onto a computer that can actually just, if it's cleverly written, just bleed out the information that goes through the processor and everything in an unencrypted form. So, you know, passwords, keys, security keys, all that sort of thing. So this vulnerability, normally you hear about vulnerabilities, you know, from Windows or Mac OS or whatever. And after a short while, a patch is produced, that's to say a piece of software that corrects the software error. The difference here is that the error is in the hardware. It's the way the hardware works. And therefore, although the software patches have and are being produced to mitigate this risk, it can only ever mitigate it. It will never go away. And for the life of that computer, and you can't even go out and buy a computer and be quite confident that it's not in that one. It will probably be even newly announced chips for the next year or two, at least, given what the development cycle of processors is. And also, when they come to fix it, how will they fix it without making computers a lot slower, because it was a speeding up function that they took advantage of. It's basically, it was a predictive function. So one of the things that processors do is in their spare time, they try and guess what the program might want to know or do next, and then it does it. Now, often it's right, in which case that's an efficient thing to do because it's all, you know, that result is then waiting. But sometimes it has to throw that result away because the you know, it predicted the program was going to turn right, it turned left, as it were, and therefore that's not needed. And so this predictive capability was being used because when the processor throws it away, it was throwing it away in an unsecured area and very hard to secure that sort of thrown away information. So it's possible to write software that would cause all sorts of data to be passed through the processor as a prediction and then thrown away and then read by the malware. So
if you take away that ability, because that's where the flaw is,
yeah,
do we have to live with slower computers than we thought we were going to?
Yeah, I mean, depending on what you're doing. So if you're doing gaming where the majority of the work is done by, you know, graphics processors and not what input-output base, you know, in terms of bringing in data, putting it back out again, processing data, then that's less affected. If, however, you're running something that's sort of database-related, then that can be, you know, slowed down by 30% by disabling that feature. And the problem with that is, although you say, oh, that's all right, I don't run databases, well, the internet is pretty much a database. So all the servers, that are, you know, all these huge server farms that, you know, take up the size of several football pitches each, all with these row upon row of computer that serve up web pages, they're all potentially hit. And particularly because of the way that servers work, where often you get more than one website sitting on a particular server or cluster of servers. So what that means is that it's possible for people to create even websites to breach server farms and get into everything else that's connected to that. And so that's a really big problem. And although it's not just Intel that's hit by that, because as I say, AMD is hit by that, and you might think, well, you know, not a lot of AMD computers about, but ARM is hit by that. Now, ARM, you may not know the name, or I know you know the name, but a listener may not know the name. That is used, that technology is used in the vast majority of tablets and smartphones, including Apple stuff. So you say, oh, well, now hold on, Apple produce Apple chips. Well, they do, but they do it using licensed technology from ARM, the underlying technology of Apple's sort of A9, A10, A10X, and all of those sorts of processors in its iPads and iPhones, is ultimately ARM, which, by the way, was a British company until very recently. It's a great shame that's one of the crown jewels that we lost. So this is a problem in terms of how do we make ourselves secure now, and what do we do about this going forward? Because it's not even an easy thing for them to fix. So it means that we're going to have this sort of vulnerability. In addition to all the software ones that will still be coming up, we're going to have this underlying weakness. And this has been going on for 20 years. So one has to say, you know, although we don't have any evidence that anyone's been utilizing it, you know, frankly, if anyone is being utilizing it, it's probably, you know, the CIA or someone like that.
I was just about to say that, yeah.
Yeah, well, yes, because, well, they have form on this, don't they? Because there were other security weaknesses, vulnerabilities, that when they came to the attention of the CIA, instead of bringing it to the manufacturer's attention so they could fix it, they decided to, in quotes, keep it secret and developed a toolkit of software tools to allow them to take advantage of the vulnerability and use that to spy upon others. Now, you could say, well, that's well and good. That's what we, you know, that's what we want the CIA to be doing. The problem with that is that they've shown that they were unable to keep those cyber weapons under wraps, which is a bit like having a nuclear arsenal but not being able to stop your enemies from taking control of it. And in fact, if you think back to the WannaCry outbreak, which was that ransomware outbreak, which we're told was an attack by North Korea. It's the one that hit the NHS and many other organizations across the world. The attack may have come from North Korea, it was made using tools stolen from the CIA. Therein lies the problem. So you've got these vulnerabilities. The industry has been working secretly, you know, Intel and others have been sharing what they know with software manufacturers, and the idea was for them to be able to patch the problem, to fix the problem in software, or at least mitigate it in software, before any of us got to know about it. Unfortunately for them, you know, others found the vulnerability and published before they had finished patching it, so they're still the last of the patches are going in. And some of those patches, Intel released a patch very hurriedly and then found that Microsoft released a patch very hurriedly and then found that on AMD chips it caused them to crash, which wasn't helpful. So they promptly withdrew the patch. So it's all a big mess at the moment. And there's, in a sense, you know, you know the expression, we're all in it together. This time we really are all in it together, because no one's going to be really truly protected from this, which makes us perhaps think about the fact that, you know, we should always think about what we store on computers, and particularly what we store online, which is just another way of storing it on someone else's computers on a server farm in America. Because anything that we commit to a computer is not completely safe. It never was, but this brings into focus the fact that really it isn't completely safe, and you should think very carefully about what you're prepared to put online. I did also think, just as an add-on thought, that although other processors are affected, the Intel ones are arguably more affected because they're susceptible to both Spectre and Meltdown, which are sort of variants, let's say. In the past, I would have said, well, yeah, but it's still better to stick with Intel chips because they're clearly the best processor chips. But actually, in the last year or a year and a half, AMD have made something of a comeback. I mean, up until then, for 10, 15 years before that, the stock advice was buy Intel. You know, the AMD chips run hot. They're not, you know, as powerful. They're not as well designed. But with the launch of AMD's Ryzen chips, R-Y-Z-E-N, that has started to change. Intel was found to be somewhat resting on its laurels because it got caught out, because as the world moved away from desktop and even laptop PCs towards mobile devices such as tablets and smartphones, it was left with processors that were inappropriate. They were far too high energy usage for those sorts of devices. They were built for desktops. And so most of the last few years, Intel has been concentrating not on making their chips faster and faster, which was always the way, but rather trying to make them more energy efficient, so much so that Moore's Law, this idea that every 18 months the computer power of our systems doubles, Moore's Law came under threat, and so much so that they took their eye off the ball, in my view, and AMD have sort of snuck on them, up on them with these Ryzen chips, and are now a viable alternative, and given the combination of Spectre and Meltdown, may actually be a better choice in terms of, again, trying to mitigate the risk.
Let's go to the phone lines, because George in Devon has given me a ring. George, very good morning to you.
Good morning to you. Good morning.
How are you?
Well, okay, I'm getting there slowly. I'm blind, and I can't use my mobile phone anymore, and I just need some help. Because I said, do you know, it took me 5 attempts to get through to you on my hand set in the house. But the technology is there, I'm told, by the Action for Blind. I went to a meeting recently, and they said the technology is there, but nobody's doing about it. They can make a mobile phone for blind people very easily. So why don't they?
Hello, George. Good morning. I'm sorry to hear, you know, you were having problems, particularly in getting through. There are mobile phones which are designed for use by blind people.
Well, I've got a Doro, but that doesn't help me.
Okay, which sort do you have? Is it a smartphone or is it a
which one it is, but it was recommended by Action for Blind. It's easy to use, but I can't dial on it because I can't see.
Yeah.
See, we don't need a screen. We don't need email. We don't need text messages because we can't see the screen anyway. So if they've removed all of that and replaced it with something which is voice recognition, the idea is that you can press your button and say taxi or say Sainsbury's or say surgery, yes, and it will dial it. Once you remove the screen and all the other rubbish in there, well, it's not rubbish for people who've got vision, but it's rubbish for people who can't see. Yep. If they remove all of that, it opens up a big space in the back of a phone to put other things in for people who are blind.
Yeah. So, George,
and I heard recently that 300 million units, if they were made, would be snapped up immediately, because worldwide, they've got no records of any people who are blind in China, and there's millions of people who are blind in China. In India, they could all benefit from a phone made specifically for blind people.
Now, the
Doro is a great phone, but I still can't use it.
Okay, so the Doros are not specifically made for blind people. They're made for people that have, in some cases, visual impairment, but more partial sighted than complete blindness. George, there are two approaches that manufacturers use to allow blind people to successfully use mobile phones. One is to have a traditional type mobile phone with physical buttons on it. And the way that is used, that you can actually literally feel your way around the keypad. The center key has a small indentation to let you know where your finger is on it. So that's one approach. The other approach is to use a smartphone. That's to say, a phone where the whole front surface is just a piece of glass. But then to use what are called accessibility features on the phone that can be switched on. So this can be done with, say, an Apple iPhone in particular, but also with competitive Android phones. And those ones then use voice recognition and speech feedback. And although I'm not blind, I use the feature where I dial on my phone using my voice. So, you know, if I'm in the car or if I'm just busy with my hands doing something else, I will just say, you know, something like, well, I won't say it out loud, but you know, you can say, hey, Shlomo, whatever, call this number. And it confirms that's the number you want. And you say yes. Or I can say, send this text message. And then I can dictate the text message. And then you say, it'll read it back to you. And then you say send. And it says sent. So that's the other approach. So you either go the tactile approach and have the basic phone functionality of being able to dial numbers and answer incoming calls. Or you go the voice recognition stroke speech, automated speech side, and that will have the benefit of allowing you to do more and also reading to you, for example, the contents of the screen. So if, for example, on an Apple iPhone, if you just swipe two fingers down from the top of the screen, it reads to you the contents of the screen, which can be anything from a web page to an ebook. So that gives you a lot more functionality. Yes, it doesn't have tactile buttons that you can actually feel, but it allows you to do pretty much anything by voice. And I would say of the two, Apple's accessibility features, although Apple devices are more expensive typically, I would say in terms of their accessibility for your needs, arguably a little bit more straightforward. Finally, sorry, if I could just say finally, I would just say that if you do go for something like that and you buy it online, make sure you pay for it with a credit card and make sure that, you know, your right to return it is there. So typically you get, say from Apple, you get 14 days, what they call a remorse period, when you can return it for pretty much any reason and get a full refund. And that would be a good thing, because even if you go in store and ask them to demonstrate to you, the proof of the pudding will be in the eating. And if you have, you know, a week or two in order to try it out, if it doesn't meet your needs, then you can send it back. And additionally, and I'm not just promoting Apple, because Google do this as well, but Apple have particularly good support. You know, they're more expensive, but some of that goes towards the quality of support. And they will help talk you through setup and all of this sort of thing. So I don't think it's true to say that there aren't phones that, you know, are designed. They might not be designed only for use by blind people, but they're designed for use also by blind people.
There you go, George. I hope that helped. One of the problems for George is that he's phoning from Devon. If you were very near a very, very large shopping centre with maybe an Apple store or a Samsung store or any of those, it's worth going along and seeing what they'll do in terms of even in store giving you like a few weeks to bring things back, because a lot of the big companies do that. We're going to go and talk to, staying in that area of the country, to Joanne in Dorset. Very good morning to you, Joanne. What's your problem? It's a Facebook problem, isn't it?
Oh, God, I'm desperate, and I'm not technically minded. So I have a Facebook account with a picture of my two dogs, and it's all fine. I've noticed lately people have been telling me, I've, you know how you get a friend's request, you could either, like, delete or accept?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've got a Facebook request from myself.
To do what?
To either delete or request. Confirm or delete.
And you've only got one account. You've only ever had one Facebook account.
Yeah, I wouldn't even know how to set up a second one. But I've looked at it, and it's got some of them are parallel. The Christmas cake I made are on both, and there's some comments on both. But I didn't set it up, and it's got no picture, whereas my one has pictures of my two dogs. And I don't know why I've got a Facebook account from me.
Hmm.
For a request. So I don't know whether just to delete it and then that might ruin the other stuff, or I don't know what to do.
Are you sure? I mean, first of all, do you have the ability to delete it? Are you sure that that's not some sort of nefarious account set up by someone else?
Well, I don't know.
Okay. So,
come to as a friend's request, you know, there's a list which I don't tend to accept, but you can either delete or confirm, mm-hmm. you know, so it's like your friends or you're not. And that's where it's come up. It's come up in that friends request.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would reject it on the grounds that you don't know what it is. if you have access to the actual account, if your credentials will get you into, I mean, you've either got one account or you've got two, so it would typically have different access details. I mean, the first point, as I say, is just reject that. There's no reason to accept it. If you in any way don't understand what it is or doubt its veracity, reject it. And then if you've got access to it, you can try, you know, it just... If you can log on to it, just try and do a test delete of some part.
Well,
of
I can
it,
because or I, even... I click on like my name or yeah. the so-called picture, and a lot of it's the same. It's almost like it's been copied. But I certainly wouldn't have the technology because I didn't set it up in the first place to even create one. So I don't know whether just delete it and forget about it.
Well, I would. I would, and if there's no other indication that it still exists, then I wouldn't worry about it. If it continues to persist, then in fact you can contact Facebook themselves and ask them to look into it and say, you know, this is not something, this appears to be a copy of my account in some way. What is it? And,
yeah.
You know, it's not me. And, you know, if it bears enough resemblance to yours, they can and usually will take it down for you.
Because it's true. I mean, it's sort of parallel, and not being technically minded, I'm just like, if I delete it, will that affect my one? But it shouldn't do.
Well, if you make changes in one, does it reflect in both?
Well, it's got my Christmas cake up on there that I posted.
Right, but if you now make a change that you're making the change, does it affect both?
I haven't tried that.
Okay, so that's the thing to
check. If I make a change on the false one, say.
Well, no, I think you'll probably make it on your own one,
wouldn't
you?
Make it on your own one and see if it ripples through. If it doesn't ripple through, then that's a copy that was made at some point in the past, either accidentally by you or someone else. If they are connected, then again, I'd speak to Facebook about that because that would be rather strange. So one would imagine they're not linked, that one is a copy of the other at a particular point in time. But try it. Reject the request. Make a change on your one. If the other one persists in existing, then ask Facebook to take it down. If it's not you and it's not something you want, then it has no business being there, really.
Brilliant. Joanne, hope that's all helped for you. It's either that or you have indeed gone into the Twilight Zone, which was what? There was a slight pause from Fevzi and me when you read that out. And I don't know, I might just be second-guessing, but that's exactly what I thought. I thought we have joined into a parallel universe, and she's doing that.
If you look out on the wing of the aircraft and there's something playing with the engine, then you know you've got to worry.
Oh, great. Okay. Right.
There's William so Shatner much. Is the only one who would have got that, I suspect, but okay, that's fine.
So it is the tech phone-in here on 5 Live between now and, in 3:30. And Fevzi is going to stay up with me all the way through. So many questions are coming in, both on Twitter, on social media, on text, on email as well, and on the phones. Some came in much earlier this evening. I just wanted to ask you a quick couple of ones. Not long answers, I don't think, on these ones. This one from Dayglow Gal, who says, I can't tell you how happy I am that Fevzi's back. My happiness is complete. Please ask him what will be the next big thing that will have us all choking over our cornflakes.
That's a good question because we've just had the CES show in Las Vegas, which used to be called the Consumer Electronics Show, now no longer stands for that, just called CES for some strange reason. I know it's bizarre, it just doesn't stand for anything anymore. Notwithstanding the fact that they had a blackout and water leaks in the building, which wasn't great, we saw a number of trends there. So we've all seen, you know, Amazon Echo type devices and Google's home assistant devices. And so far we've been used to being offered these smart speakers, as they're called, as objects in and of themselves to buy. But increasingly what we're seeing and what we've seen at CES is that these technologies, and they're fighting it out between Amazon and Google as to which is going to be the dominant technology. It's like a format war. These technologies being built into everything that you can imagine. So this idea in the future that we will buy smart speakers, it's probably, you know, somewhat redundant. Everything that we buy will not only have some smarts in it, so AI is part of the answer, artificial intelligence is part of it, but the way that we interact with that artificially intelligent entity inside each of the objects that we coexist with, be it objects that we buy or those that we find in public spaces, they will be voice activated. You will literally, well, they had an AI voice activated toilet.
Brilliant.
For example, which was great. Actually, I can see the benefit of that because sometimes you don't want to touch the flusher, do you? Let's be honest. And if you can flush a toilet by voice, so much the better.
If you're in a public toilet and you start saying, Alexa,
flush.
Flush. It's just not going to go well, is it? I have a friend who's got a daughter called Alexa.
That's a bit unfortunate.
It is, isn't it?
it's funny, isn't it? It's like all those people that sort of grew up being called Britney and so forth, and after, you know, pop stars, and probably now there'll be a lot of people called Alexa. I'm sorry,
no one
waking
called
up
Google.
Everyone's machine. Yeah,
and no one called Siri, so that's okay.
Yeah, I know. What's all that about, Siri?
You know, you can change the name on the Amazon devices.
Yeah, you
so
can
that
have.
It does. It calls
you
it
can
something
have
else.
Amazon or computer. Or Alexa.
A computer just sounds like 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, or Star Trek, isn't it? I mean, in fact, if you tell Alexa to close the pod bay doors, it knows what you mean.
Brilliant.
It's got great film references in it, I have to say. And also, if you ask it if it knows how, you get an interesting response. Or if it's going to kill us all.
There was an interesting story the other week about somebody who had a Google device and someone who had an Amazon device. And had the two of them talking almost to each other.
Yeah, it's kind of fun.
That's one way of it.
So to answer the question, you know, this it's not just the voice interface, but the artificial intelligence, the fact that these devices are getting increasingly smart. And the reason for that breakthrough is not just because we have faster processors and better programming, but we now have access to, or computers have access to, what's known as big data. This idea that, you know, so for example, every time you speak to, you know, an Amazon Echo device or a Google device, the way that it works is that a recording of your voice is sent instantaneously over the internet to the servers at Amazon or Google. Their programs do the analysis to work out what you said and then come up with a suitable reply and squirt the reply back. So, in fact, the smart speaker is actually a dumb speaker. There's no real smarts in the speaker itself. But so those voice recordings of you giving commands are not just used for the purpose of giving you a reply, but they're also stored and analyzed, which is why when you get an Echo unit, for example, it works out of the box. In the past, when you had voice recognition, you'd have to spend half an hour literally training it and reading sort of set passages to it repeatedly until it got your accent and your intonation and way of speaking, and it would be specific to you. But the reason why these devices work out the box and can understand almost any accent is because of this huge amount of data, all these different voices that they've got recordings of. And because computer programs and AI programs in particular have access to huge numbers of photographs, huge amounts of video footage, huge numbers of voice recordings, they can actually develop intelligence, because with experience can, to an extent, come intelligence. So it's quite an interesting thing, but I think artificial intelligence is the big thing. Of course, people like Elon Musk have said it's an existential threat. As Professor Stephen Hawking has said, we should get off the planet and run is our best survival strategy, because there will probably be about 5 minutes between the point at which AI is actually not very good.
Are you printing something out there?
No, it's just decided to wake up by itself. I was talking AI, it didn't like it, frankly. It's getting the hump. This large printer has decided to, I think it's cleaning its jets, as it were. It's a euphemism for something else, I'm sure. But notwithstanding noisy printer. There is a point at which they're going to get really useful, be able to solve almost all of our problems. You know, things like climate change and so forth will be nothing to their intellect. But there's that 5 minutes when they become really useful before they decide that we're surplus to requirements. Yeah. And therein lies the problem, because there are serious scientists at MIT and other places whose whole life's work now is to try and work out what instructions could we give an AI program today that would ripple through to the future generations of AI, which will be self-replicating, that would keep us safe. Yeah, so we've you know, in science fiction, we've got Asimov's laws, haven't we? The laws of robotics. You know, that you should never harm a human, or by your inaction allow a human to be harmed. That sort of thing. That actually doesn't really work. It doesn't even work with the first generation. And the idea is, we already use computer technology to design the next generation of computer chips. And you see that because even if you look at an Intel chip, just the same chip as you'll find in your laptop, it's got billions of transistors on it. I mean, a human being couldn't even draw a billion transistors in their lifetime, much less, you know, design a chip using them. So we have to use computers to design each next generation. And each next generation is faster and smarter than the one before, and therefore the amount of the design work that it can take on itself increases. And it doesn't take a huge leap of the imagination to imagine that at some point the processor will be able to design its own progeny. So not only will it reproduce, by most standards it will be a form of reproduction, but each generation will be smarter than the last. So unlike humans, where we are, you know, in the short term, evolutionary at a standstill. I'm so sorry. There we go. It just really doesn't like all this talk of artificial intelligence. I'm so sorry. It's the first time it's done that. It's not a coincidence.
Let's go to the phones. David in Stoke-on-Trent, a very good morning to you. How are you?
I'm fine.
Right, what's your point?
Well, I was very interested in what Fabsy was saying with regard to the problem that they've identified with the computer chip, with the potential for it to be hacked. And one of the concerns that I've had for a while is that if I go into a HTTPS or a secure means of purchasing something, if I use my credit card or my debit card, obviously I enter the detail into it. So I'm entering in, obviously, the number and also the security ID. Can that be hacked through this way then, Fabsy, as far as you know?
Yeah, in principle, yes, anything can be hacked because it is talking about the information that flows through the processor, and everything flows through the processor at one point or another.
Yeah.
And also it flows through the processor at certain points in an unencrypted, that's to say unscrambled state. So
right.
Even if it's stored in a scrambled state, it's decoded before it's processed. You know? So processors can't process gobbledygook. They have to unscramble it. And in that state, it's vulnerable.
Right.
So, yes, anything that your computer's processor and indeed your computer sees or stores or processes is potentially hackable. Because what they do is they feed the processor instructions that cause the processor to preemptively make certain bits of information available because it thinks it's the next thing it's going to ask for. It then asks for something else, causes it to shed the data, and then copies that data that's been shed. That's not an easy program to write, I can tell you, because you get little bits. But with the right programming skills and tenacity, and you know, this is a big prize because it affects potentially almost every computer built in the last 20 years. So it's worthwhile. It's a big target, and it's worth. And you know, I'm sorry to say, but some of the best programmers work for the bad guys because
it's
very remunerative, particularly since the advent of ransomware, where you know you encrypt people's data and then ransom it back to them. You know, that started just a few short years ago. Yet the number of ransomware programs has grown exponentially because it's so profitable. And you know, they are well-run businesses. Very often these criminal endeavors, and they know the importance of investing. So they invest in their skills and money into these because you know. It's a problem.
The problem that we have, though, is at this moment it's not been done.
No, of course.
But
not.
There's no way that we can tell whether or not it is just about to happen.
No,
we can also not know that it hasn't been done.
Good point.
We have no evidence that it has been done. That's not the same as saying it hasn't been done. You could argue, look, this vulnerability has been there for 20 years. What are the odds that no one's twigged it before? Why have why have three groups tweaked it all at once? I mean, sometimes that does happen. You know, sometimes it's just something is ripe to be discovered. It's, you know, like DNA or nylon or whatever. It gets discovered in more than one location at the same time. But it's equally possible, I'd posit, that actually it has been done. But, you know, if you're using a tool like that, it's like when we broke the Enigma code in the war. We couldn't let people know that we'd broken it, or the enemy know that we'd broken it. So sometimes we had to let, you know, ships be attacked as if we didn't know they were going to be attacked. So if it's being used judiciously, you wouldn't necessarily know.
The paranoias that come on in this time of the morning aren't useful to this sort of thing, are they?
You know what? Can I just make an overarching comment, which is don't lose any sleep over this, because there's not much you can do about it. And you know that saying about having the wisdom to change what you can change and accept what you can't, and know to have the wisdom, you know, to tell the difference. And this is kind of like that. This is one of the things that you can mitigate. You should apply the patches. You may, when you buy your next computer, choose your processor carefully. But ultimately, it's going to be a vulnerability that's going to be with us for a while. But it's different because it's going to be there permanently, the vulnerability, but still we already live in a world where every week there's a different vulnerability anyway. It's just a different threat at each level. This one's more dangerous because you know, it gives time for people to you know, develop ways around even the mitigating software. So it is a problem, but it's not something that I would personally lose sleep over. Everyone is in the same boat, and wait till quantum computers are invented if you think you've got problems now.
David, thanks for that. Want to cross to Jack now, and this is a slightly different question, but it's also the same one in basically Big Brother. But sometimes Big Brother works in our favours. Jack, you're phoning us from Sussex. Whereabouts in Sussex are you?
I'm in Brighton.
Excellent. Yeah. Right. What's your point?
Yeah, I wanted to ask Fevzi. Hi there, Fevzi.
Hello, Jack.
I wanted to ask you, I got a new mobile phone in the last few weeks.
Yep.
And just playing around with it, setting a few things up, just playing around. And then all my contact, I just wanted to ask how my information was transferred from my old phone to the new phone, because all my contacts
appeared
on it.
Yep.
Yeah. And I didn't see anything specific saying, do you want to transfer your contacts, or if you do this on this phone, your contacts are going to come over to the new phone. And yeah. I was just sort of, you know, a bit surprised about it and curious how my information was, you know, yeah, being going around the internet and from one phone to the other phone or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Jack, it's a very good question and a shrewd observation on your part, but some people don't spot that. The most common way in which that happens is that your phone, it depends on the make and model, but often they get backed up into what's called the cloud, the internet. The benefit of it is you've got a backup, which is, you know, physically in a different place. So God forbid if your phone was stolen or there was a fire and, you know, you had a local backup, that would go with it. Storing this stuff up in the cloud has that benefit, that you've got a reasonably secure independent backup, and it also has this ability, this benefit of allowing you to then change phones and set up the new phone very quickly. So my guess is that it's probably been backed up to the cloud. My concern is that if it is the case that you didn't know that was happening. Which phone have you got?
It's an Android. Well, it's just a cheap smart. It's called Alcatel.
Yeah,
Pixie 4. It's an Android phone. Okay. I checked online, and some people suggested because it's an Android and it's Google, and that if I've signed into my Gmail account on the phone, that might have done it. Could that have done it, do you think?
Yeah, so it depends how you've backed up the phone. So have you connected this phone to your PC or laptop?
No, this is all just via Wi-Fi. I mean, let's say on my old phone, you know, I've never selected any option that I know of to back up the phone. I mean, I know that in options on some of these apps, there are things about do you want to share contacts or sync data or things.
Sure.
But I've never sort of looked into that. I've never really understood what that was about.
Sure. Are these? Can I just ask you, Jack, if you don't mind, are these contacts that are in the Android's own contacts software, or is this in a third-party app?
No, I mean, they're just, you know, on a phone, you just store your contact list. It's just your telephone contact
list. So, Jack, it's as far as I can see, it's happening one of two ways. Either unbeknownst to yourself, you managed to back up the contents of your original phone into the cloud, onto the internet, and it's come back down. The other possibility is that it's been copied from directly from your phone, that you've had both of them switched on and connected by Wi-Fi, and one has had the smarts to copy across from the other. Were they similar phones?
Not really. Well, the old one was a Samsung phone,
right.
Yeah, from about probably 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
The new one is an Alcatel phone.
Yeah.
And well, I don't know it. I mean, I just assumed that they've gone through the Gmail account. I mean, would these apps? Because I've seen that in some of these applications, there's a thing called Sync. Mm-hmm. Is it Sync?
S-Y-N-C? Yeah. I'm not sure what that's about. Synchronization. Yeah. It means to bring two copies of things into synchronization so they hold the same data.
Yeah.
So you can sync databases, or your contact list is a database. Yeah. So I think either at app level or operating system level, these things have been synchronized. Does mean you've got a backup somewhere. You've got to maybe look a bit more into where that might be if you don't want it to be the case. But it's quite common, and it's quite common, by the way, for apps to make copies of contact lists and so forth. I found this with Fitbit. I had a Fitbit device, you know, these sort of trackers that track your walking and physical metrics. And the device itself is almost useless without downloading the app onto your smart device, your smartphone. And when I did something that most people don't do, I read, you know, the terms and conditions and the privacy terms as well. And I found that actually the first thing that it does when you install the app is it makes a copy of your contact list and takes it.
Yeah.
And it uses that as a sort of community marketing, because it then contacts other Fitbit users that it knows about and tells them that you're now a Fitbit user and tries to sort of build community. But it's quite intrusive, and it is amazing. For example, at an app level, it's amazing what they copy that they don't need to for the purpose of the app working.
Very interesting. I've just had a tweet from Arctic Eddie, who says, can you help regarding family devices, all on iOS this time, under the same iTunes account, ding, 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 but constantly getting each other's messages? Is there a better way to set things up?
Yes, I mean, if you've got a later version of the iOS operating system, it is possible for a device to share multiple sort of linked family accounts, and you can do that. If you're getting each other's messages, it's not correctly set up, because you should be able to do that such that they're all quite separate. So look at family accounts and how they're dealt with. But it assumes you're using a later version of iOS. I think it came in with, I think, iOS 10, and we're now on 11. So look for those features. But it is a problem. I mean, before that, you had the ability, for example, to set up accounts so that children couldn't access certain apps and so forth and certain data. But it didn't become truly separate until later version of iOS. So should be possible. Not quite sure how you've managed to get it, sharing messages, but it does suggest that it's not correctly set up and that it's not truly independent, and you shouldn't do anything on that account thinking that it is, because other things are probably accessible at that point as well.
It is the Tech Phone-In on 5 Live. I'm Nick Garner. Between now and 5 o'clock, the Tech Phone-In is for the next 24 minutes, which means we're going to have to rush through. So what I've been doing, I'm joined by Fevzi, who basically knows everything about technology, which is a huge thing to know about. What I've done is I've now tried to sort of build a lot of the answers so they all go together. So, for instance, Planet of Dub has been in touch on social media and says, can Fevzi go over some different Wi-Fi setups, mesh extenders, etc., to help avoid Wi-Fi black spots in a medium-sized house? Because Catherine is on the line, and this is linked to Catherine's problem, who joins us now from Cardiff. Catherine, very good morning to you.
Good morning.
In a nutshell, what's your problem?
My problem, which I've had for years, is my internet connection on my desktop keeps dropping out. It's not affecting other devices, so it's not the internet as such. I've changed the leads on the computer. I've changed internet provider. I've changed my security over the years. and I've reset it, not back to the factory settings, but refreshed it, and it keeps dropping out continually, and it's driving me nuts.
Right. Hello, Catherine. So you said you changed the wire. Am I to take it that this is a wired internet connection, not Wi-Fi?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. It's interesting that the problem has survived across so many different, you know, variables being changed.
Yes.
I would say look at the drivers for the Ethernet adapter. So the way that computers work is that they're effectively a Meccano set of parts from different manufacturers that are bolted together to perform as a single unit. For the operating system to be able to understand what's in that particular computer, there are pieces of software that act as an interface between the operating system and the hardware itself. Those little pieces of software are known as software drivers, and they enable the different things to work, be it an external printer or the Ethernet port. It may be that the software driver that you're using for the Ethernet port is faulty, which would explain, for example, why, you know, it doesn't matter what else you've changed, it still drops. And the worst case would be if it was a hardware fault, in which case, you know, rather like the hardware flaws we were talking about before, that's not really solvable other than use an external adapter. So you can try updating the software drivers.
I did that. I've tried so many different things over the years. I remember researching something on the internet that said, and I do remember doing something about the driver, but I don't think it made a heck of a difference, to be honest.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's worth making sure that you've done it, and that even if you did it previously, doing it again, because they may have further updated the drivers and that may have subsequently solved the problem. How old is the PC out of interest?
It's approximately 3+ years, 3 or 4 years, maybe.
Okay. And
4 years.
Which operating system are you running, please?
Windows 10.
Okay, fine. All right, so try the software drivers. If you want to do an experiment, you can do this. It's possible to create another Ethernet connection on your computer by buying an adapter which goes from USB socket into Ethernet. It might not give you the full speed, but it will give you enough for you to test it. And if you buy that in such a way that if it doesn't solve your problem, you can return it, then actually that's a very simple experiment to do, because you plug it in, you may not even have to install separate drivers. Windows may recognize it and provide you with a second Ethernet port. You can then plug it into that and see if the problem goes away. If the problem goes away, then you've isolated the problem to either the hardware or the driver of that Ethernet port. If the problem persists, then you know that it's not the Ethernet port or its driver, and it's something else, and then you have to start looking at the other variables. But you kind of need to do it as a process of elimination.
Catherine?
When I've taken it to the computer shop, I've done it twice, and they haven't had any problems at all.
Mm. Okay.
If it's the driver, presumably they would have an issue with it as well, would they?
Yes, they should do. I mean, if you connect to the internet using Wi-Fi, does it also drop, or is it then solid?
The kids have got iPhones, and I've got a tablet, except an iPad, and that's no problem at all.
But that particular machine, can it connect via Wi-Fi and stably?
I don't know how to do that. Because it's got a cable, I can do it Wi-Fi as well, can I?
Yes, yeah. So your computer will be able to connect wirelessly or via Ethernet. And ironically, Ethernet is normally the more stable way of connecting to the internet. But if there's a particular problem with that Ethernet cable or adapter or something, then again, another experiment is to switch it to Wi-Fi. If the problem persists on Wi-Fi, then it's more likely it's not going to be necessarily the cable or the Ethernet port. It's then going to be your service, and that would tend to be backed up by the fact that when you take the computer elsewhere, the problem goes away.
Catherine, I hope that sorts out. I think that the main advice really is to go through the processes, and as Fevzi says, try and get it working on Wi-Fi as well, or find a way that you can buy something but send it back if it's not the thing that you need, and have a look at those servers. That's a coded message that we can't really explain, but it's a coded message, and I'm sure you can work it out. Thanks for your call. Now, the next set of calls that I want to try and band together, because there are so many people that I want to get into.
Because you know I'm incapable of giving a brief answer, you've noticed this.
I didn't say that. Right, hi Fevzy, I have a 7-year-old Compaq HP 5307 UK desktop PC. It started to run slow, so I did a reformat using the F key. I've installed all the updates, firmware, drivers, and free Avast antivirus, etc. However, it still seems slower than it was when it was new. Are there any other things that you can suggest I try? I've backed all my files up and done all the right things. It's running Windows 7. Yeah. So frustrated. Thank you so much from Simon in Blackburn. That, coupled with morning, I am due an iPad upgrade. This is Steve in Hampshire. Do I go for a 10.5 or a 12.9? Is it just size that's the difference, or is one better than the other? And that links with Steve in Brighton, who's on the phone, who says...
These are all the same question, aren't
they? Well, no, these are... Well, they're pretty much the same answer.
Come on.
I think they're the same answer here. We've got a 7-year-old Compaq. We've got a new iPad. Are they getting better or are they not getting better? If you're going for a 10.5 or a 12.9, that means you're on the
pros.
Is that the pros?
Yeah.
So whether, I mean, you know, we can work out an answer to that one. And then Steve in Brighton has given us a call. Steve, what's your point very quickly?
Hello, Fevzy.
Hello.
Nice to talk to you. Fevzy, I have an iPad. It's an iPad 2, 5 years old.
Yeah.
When I go to type in emails, sometimes it's absolutely fine. Another time, the typing goes so slow, it takes seconds for each letter to do. And then if I make a mistake and want to delete it, I can hit the delete button, but it will actually then, it will keep deleting one after the other after the other.
Yeah, so it's buffering your key presses, so it's not losing them, but it's not affecting them immediately. This is a problem that I've suffered for years, particularly with older iPads. The pros don't seem to suffer from it. I've had long conversations with senior techs at Apple, and they've conceded the problem occurs, doesn't occur to everyone with the same machine. Not really fixable as far as I can see. I mean, the things that you could try and do is to reduce the strain on the machine by making sure that you've shut down any apps that are not necessary, you know, but they're being run in the background. Make sure that you don't overload, you know, overfill the storage on it. Those sorts of things. Make sure that, and the problem is, of course, you can't now upgrade to the latest version of iOS, which is a problem for Apple users because, unlike Microsoft, so with Microsoft, they would continue doing, for example, security patches for Windows 7, even though since then there's been 8.1.10. They will still do security patches. Apple, on the other hand, will only update the latest version. So if you're on iOS 11 and now they want to mitigate, you know, the bugs that we've been talking about, they'll do it on 11, but they don't go back and patch the earlier versions. This means that you have an underlying security issue with a 5-year-old machine. It's not just that it's slow and it lacks the features of new iOS. There are actually security issues with that. Compound that with the fact that it's bugging the hell out of you with this. I'm not saying go and buy a new one, but... you know, you are running some risks by continuing to run the old one. And I'll be delighted to hear a solution. I've never found a reliable solution for that delay problem.
The only similarity that I've had is an iPhone 6 that was doing exactly the same thing that I had. And I was convinced it was part of what I'm sure you've talked about before, about Apple slowing things down and racking down the speed of the processor that was causing it. I took my phone into an Apple store and they did the tests and they found that it wasn't being done at all. So I did a complete restore. That was doing a full backup and then onto the computer rather than onto the cloud. And then doing a complete restore and clean of the device. And it did seem to speed things up. And I don't know if that's the same with iPads or not. The problem, as you said, is that we're now onto an operating system that the iPad 2 doesn't support or isn't supported on the iPad 2. And that means that there's going to be a problem there, isn't it? I mean, it gets to this point, doesn't it, where we all have to sort of realise that maybe the hardware that we thought we could rely on for 10 years just doesn't do the job anymore.
No, and in fact, Apple was in the past a highly innovative company. Arguably, it's in some ways it still is, but they were innovating at such a pace that And the user base was relatively small, and particularly on Macs, it was particularly small, and therefore they could get away with innovating but leaving behind existing users, or at least a portion of their existing users, and not supporting them. Microsoft, who's been at this for a long time, is a more mature stage in their cycle, which Apple is sort of trying to evolve into now. But Microsoft has been, you know, it supported Windows XP for 13 years, you know, and, you know, what else can you buy these days that the company will give you free support for 13 years with updates and so forth? There aren't many things. They had to kill it in the end because it was such a good product that people weren't moving on from there. So by all means, those sorts of refreshes can help. Same with a PC, you know, wipe and reinstall can help if you know what you're doing. Make sure you've got proper backups before you do it. But that particular problem of the keyboard entry lag, it's been a bugbear because it doesn't even happen on every one of the same model. So it makes you think that maybe it's something to do with, you know, what you're running on there. But even when I've shut down some of the background programs, it doesn't always go away, and sometimes it comes back. So no good solution to that, I think. I think your machine is aging. If I can address a couple of the other questions, the first one about
the HP Compact.
So machines can slow down. Older machines can slow down for quite a number of different reasons. One thing is that you shouldn't really fill the hard drive much past 80% full, because the hard drive is not just used for storing your data, it's also used by the operating system as a working area. And if you deprive it of sufficient working area, it will cause it to slow down because it needs that space. The other possibility, the idea behind that is remove what you don't need on there, either back it up or delete it if you don't need it, defragment the drive if you haven't already done so. The other possibility is a machine can slow down because of malware. If the computer has got a virus or viruses, those computer programs, because that's what they are running in the background without you knowing they're there, but they're using resources. They're using the hard disk, they're using the processor and the memory, and therefore, because it's doing all of that, you know, spamming people across the world with emails that you're not even aware of, then it may be slowing down your PC. So one of the very first things you need to do is do a full system scan. I know you mentioned you've got antivirus there. Make sure you do a full system scan in safe mode, so that will give you the best chance of picking it up. And even consider doing, without installing another antivirus, you can go to people like Symantec's website and do an online virus scan of your computer where you don't install it. It just looks onto your hard drive and scans it. That's not a bad idea. In terms of iPad Pros, the difference between the 10.5 and the current 12.9, functionally, they're almost identical. They've got the same processor. They've got the same memory options. The 12.9 screen, it doesn't sound very different to 10.5. It's actually a 50% bigger screen area and about 50% more weight. I have owned both, and I sent my 12.9 back because it was just too big and unwieldy. And I nearly kept it as a purely desktop machine just to use as an adjunct, as a second screen, because there's software like Duet that you can use to make it into a second, give yourself a touch screen against your Windows PC or Mac. So for that sort of purpose, it's great. If you want to be running, let's say, specialist software like electronic synthesizer software on it, where you've got lots of sliders and you need the screen space, that's great. Otherwise, the 10.5 is a much more handleable device, much better for reading from. Frankly, your hand gets tired holding a 12.9 after a while, even though it doesn't weigh much more than the original iPad. That's still heavy. It's a great design. I look forward to them making it even smaller and lighter with thinner bezels as well. Right. Because the 10.5 has got the thin bezel design, whereas the 12.9 still has the standard size bezels.
When are they due an upgrade? It's not going to be that long, because they've already brought out new processors for the 8 and the 10, haven't they?
Probably, my guess is it will be summer to autumn.
Which might be a good time to buy the old one. Okay, very quickly.
What they do. Yeah.
Yeah. Right, we need to move on because we have so many. And I wanted to ask you about something else as well. Let's see. Dennis in Grantham joins us now on the phone. Dennis, what's your problem?
Good morning, gentlemen. Febzy, Is it inherent with the Freeview system that there is a sound delay? I've struggled with two smart TVs. My first one was an LG, and I had a delay on that. I've just recently purchased a Samsung, and it's even worse on that. And they give you, in the expert settings, they give you a plus and minus where you can alter it, but it's not wide enough to actually encapture the sound. And to be honest, I can't stand watching it.
Yeah,
it's awful. And I've been wondering whether or not it might be due as well. This is another issue, but it may be linked. I was thinking of maybe getting fresh aerial cabling from my roof, because the cable up there must be 25 years old.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if that had an effect on it, or whether or not it is just purely inherent to the Freeview system.
Okay, so excellent question. Delays are inherent to all broadcast systems, because it takes time for a broadcast signal to go from transmitter to receiver. But before it does that, there's an encoding time. So Freeview is encoded into digital, and then it's sent out. That takes some time. And then last but certainly not least, your computer has to unscramble that signal and turn it into picture and sound. That takes time. So there is always an inherent delay. So if you'll see it, for example, if you've got a watch that's accurate to the second, and you know it's New Year's Eve and you're doing the Hogmanay celebrations or something, you'll see that it can be several seconds of delay between real time and when you see it on your screen. However, the delay varies, because some TVs have got faster and better technology than others. The aerial quality or the signal quality won't really affect the delay. It would affect the picture quality and potentially sound quality. So if you were to see, for example, pixelation or boxiness appearing on the screen, that would tend to suggest a poor signal strength.
Mm.
Some TV sets also allow you to see what the signal strength that it's receiving is, so you can go into your settings and see if that's available to you. But the delay doesn't sound to me on a Freeview set as if it is.
Is there anything that can be done then to try and match sound and vision? Because, I mean, these TVs are supposedly smart, but in the old analog days, the sound and vision were spot on.
Yeah, well, yes, because they didn't have the same sort of digital processing thing. The signals were intermixed in a way. TV sets do have, as you mentioned, they do have adjustments that you can try and use to bring them back into synchronization. And some makes and models of TV sets are worse than others.
Yeah.
Sometimes the problem can be exacerbated by the area that you're in and the way that the signal is transmitted, and that's not something you can...
Just going back about the aerials. Now, I've been told by a TV engineer this theoretically shouldn't be possible, but in the area where I live, we are served by the Waltham transmitter, but also we can get the signals from the Belmont transmitter.
Yeah.
And there is, at the moment, on my house, there are two aerials going through a splitter. And I wondered if this might have been part of the problem. But I get good signals from both. Would the splitter be affecting it at all? And in theory, should it work? Because I've been told by a TV engineer that one will interfere with the other because they're different frequencies, and you will have a complete mismatch.
So you're not actually talking about a splitter. You're talking about joining or mixing together the signals from two separate aerials into one feed.
Yes.
That's the opposite of a splitter. That's like a joiner.
Nothing that I've put in the house.
Yeah.
It is on the roof. From two aerials, that comes in the end down one lead.
Yeah, the problem that you can get with that, which may also speak to the problem that you've got, you can get what's called phase problems. So these signals are sent as waves, even though they're digital. It's digitally encoded into an analog wave that's broadcast. And those waves have an amplitude and a frequency. And if you've ever seen in the sea, sometimes you see waves coming from slightly different directions, they combine. And sometimes that gives rise to a wave that's twice as tall, but sometimes the waves cancel out and you get a dead spot in the water. The same happens with signals coming from aerials. They can either reinforce each other to make the signal stronger, or they can, to a greater or lesser extent, cancel themselves out. That's why it's not normally done, because you can't really predict how that will behave, and it may not be stable, and it may be a cause of the sort of phase delay problems that you're suffering from. Can I just say, as we've had such a busy time, if anyone didn't get their question answered, I'm on Twitter. I'll stay on Twitter for a while tonight, at Gadget Detective, if anyone wants to follow and ask a question.
I think that's I'll do my best. You're going to be very, very busy with that. There's an awful lot of people.
So I
remember
speak
once.
Very slowly.
Yeah. Dennis, thanks for your call. I remember once I was reading the news bulletins on regional television and was able to finish reading the news bulletin, run out, sit at my desk and watch on the television, and I was still watching the reading the news out because of the delay. Which is, I always try to race myself and see if I could get back there. We have got literally two more minutes, which means that I'll just say this one from Chris. I'm running Windows 7. I want to upgrade to Windows 10. Can I still do this for free?
Not at the moment. There are rumours that Windows 10 will be free again. So Windows 10 was free for, I think, about a whole year. At the moment, they're still charging for it. I would say this to you, if there isn't a compelling reason that you need to go for Windows 10, and usually there isn't, then I think Windows 7 is a very good operating system. And Windows 10 is best run on a machine that comes with Windows 10. When you upgrade, say, a 7 or an 8 or whatever to 10, you often have problems with, we've talked about drivers and so forth, you often have compatibility problems.
Brilliant.
And it's not really that much of an advance in many ways. So I would stick with your Windows 7 unless there's a really overriding reason that I don't know about.
Andrew in Wigan says, please recommend a safe messaging app I can use to talk to my children using my phone and their Wi-Fi tablets, which are not Apple devices.
Right.
Ideally, something that would be difficult for them to chat with strangers on. If that's such a massive thing, that we could be here for half an hour talking about that. Any safe ones?
Well, Telegraph is good because it's secure. It's not specifically designed to protect from children, but it is a good, secure communications app, and I think that's the foundation of any good app.
And people can't find you on Telegraph, can they?
No,
in the same way.
No.
Right. So that's that.
BBC Five Live.